My name is Jim Wallace. I've been working in Los Angeles County for about 30 years. And my dad was there before me, and my son is now there after me. And in this profession, I was basically working cold case homicides. Most of my time was spent working cold cases. I was like most of you. You know, you start off in patrol, which I did that as well. Then I went to gangs for 2 years, worked SWAT, I worked undercover for 4, and then they put me in robbery homicide. And once I was in robbery homicide, I just started working your typical homicides. And then we started looking at our unsolved. And we had a bunch of these. We had like 30 that went back to, 1972. And we thought, we should probably assign these collaterally. And you all know, if you're working on a homicide team, if you assign a case collaterally, is anything going to get done? No. And so most of our homicides just continued to be unsolved. And we would work our current cases, because those things have a deadline. We have people watching us. And no one's even calling from 1972 on this old case. So a lot of our old cases simply just did not get worked. So we decided, let's go ahead. I actually got injured. And as I was injured, I was light duty, and I was bored to tears. They put me in our intelligence detail. And that's pretty boring. It was right after 9/11, though, so there was some activity. But I decided to pick up an old cold case and try to solve it. And when we had luck with that first one, they started a detail. And that's really how I got started in this job, is I started working cold cases as a result of an accident, an injury. Now, through that process, I was not a believer. I mean, look, a lot of us in this room are Christians. Agreed? Not everyone here, but a lot of us are Christians. And I was not a Christian growing up. I didn't have any Christians in my family. I didn't have anyone who was a believer. My dad is a very committed atheist even today. He is unflinching in his atheism. But I was. My wife had a good experience growing up and where she was. And when we started having kids, she was like, hey, should we go to church to raise up our kids? I mean, so they would know. But my dad's very much in favor of Christians. He likes the idea that we have a country that is established on Christian foundations. He thinks it's a very useful delusion. It produces good people. So he would much rather live in a country in which there are Christians than in a country where there aren't. And I was more than willing to go to church the same way. Just put me in place. I'll go with you. I'll hang out with you. I don't think it's true. But at 35, I already started to have a skill set. And as I sat in that church for the first time and the preacher pitched Jesus as a smart ancient sage, I was willing to get a Bible and take a look at it. And most of you know those four attributes of reliable eyewitness testimony. I always talk about it, which is number one, were they really there to see what they said they saw? Can they be corroborated in some way? Have they changed their story over time? And do they possess a bias? Those are the four jury instructions we have in California that actually test whether an eyewitness is reliable. I simply applied those to the gospel authors to see if they could pass that test. That's really how I became a Christian. So it was through using this process that God had given me here that helped me to actually determine that it was true. So what I'm going to do this morning is kind of tie in what Jim has been talking about, wherever Jim is, in terms of morality. Why do we believe these things we call morals? And is there a good explanation for these? And could these even be used to establish the existence of God? And then in the second session, we'll, if we even have any media, we will talk about applying this to our work as cops. We're just going to jump right in. Now, if you've seen our cases on Dateline, it's not because we do spectacular work, because we don't really do spectacular work. We just do regular work that all of you are doing. But we do happen to be about 4 miles down road of Universal City. And that's where NBC Dateline is located. So they came to us years ago and said, hey, do you have a case that we could put on TV? And we said, yeah, we got a good case. It took us 11 years to get that case into trial. And over the next 11 years, as we were trying to get that case into trial, they did every other case we were working simultaneously. So that's how we ended up on Dateline as often as we did. And all of that stuff just gave me a skill set that I want to pass on. Now, a lot of you, I'm not going to be explaining anything new because you already know how to do this work. As a matter of fact, you probably do it a lot better than I do. But I think there are some things you might have been doing that you just passed right over, didn't even think about the nature of what you were doing and how you might apply this to your Christian worldview if you're a Christian, or how this might even make a case for Christianity. So what we're going to do, my son is still doing the same work that I was doing for many years before me. He is wearing the same uniform that I wore, and he has my name. We're not very creative when it comes to name. We use the same name over and over and over again. So he's got a different middle name, but I used that middle name on my second son, so I just use the same names over and over again. His name is Jim Wallace. He's doing the same work that I did for years before him. My name is Jim Wallace. I followed my dad at the same agency. His name is Jim Wallace. If you called our agency in the last 56 years and you asked for Jim Wallace, there's been somebody there to answer the phone, okay? We are the George Foreman of law enforcement. Now, some of you don't even understand that joke. So turn to the old person next to you, and they'll explain it to you, okay? Because George had three sons, and they're all named George. No, six sons, sorry. So what I want to do is kind of pass on some information that you might find helpful as you kind of think about your own careers as well, okay? About a year ago, I was asked to do a six-minute scene in a movie called God's Not Dead 2. And it was fun, but it caused me to have to think about, how quickly can you communicate your core values? If I asked you as a cop, if I'm going to give you 6 minutes to do an elevator talk on your core values, why law enforcement is so important, or why Christianity is true, could you do it? You got to cover a lot. You have to have a lot more than 6 minutes of information in your head to give a six-minute talk. Would you agree? So we're going to talk about some information from this book called God's Crime Scene. What we're going to do is we're going to look at the universe like a crime scene. So we're going to do a little bit of Death Investigations 101. Now, a lot of you already get this. You already know this, but you might not have thought about it in quite this way. So let's talk about it. I'm going to have to show you a dead body, of course, in order to do this. So let's go ahead and jump right in. Here's a dead guy laying face down. Looks suspiciously like my son Jimmy, doesn't he? Why, he was in the academy. He's got his hair shaved off. So now, how do I explain dead guys laying face down? There are a couple of ways. There's four ways to die. We don't care. You and I both know. We only care about one way that people die. We couldn't give a lick about the other three. As a matter of fact, if I can determine it's one of the other three, I get to go home. So I'm hoping it's one of the other three, right? I don't want to be here all night, but if it's a murder, I got to stay. Well, what we do is we form a list in our head, whether you thought about it or not, a list that begins with the letter E. Actually, two lists that begin with the letter E. The first is a list of evidences. And here all we have is a dead guy laying face down. So let's make a list with the evidences. We'll put them over here. And on this side, we'll make a list of all the possible ways you might explain the evidence. Make sense? So far, we have a dead guy laying face down. Four ways that people die, as you know. They can die by way of accident. They can die by some natural cause. They can die by suicide. And they can die by homicide. These are the four ways that people die. Now, we're trying to figure out which of these, because not every death scene is a crime scene. You go to DBRs, right? We call them DBRs. Why don't you guys call them dead body reports? They're not always crime scenes. It could be one of the first three, and we're going to get to go home. How do we know what this is? Well, we take a look at these two pieces of evidence, and we ask ourselves a question. Which is the best and most reasonable explanation given what we have so far in the room? And so far, you really couldn't cross off anything, because if he died of a heart attack, he would look like that. If he accidentally took too many pills, he would look like that. If he intentionally took too many pills, he would look like that. If I poisoned him with too many pills, he would look like that. So really, all these are not only equally possible, they're equally reasonable. We're not going anywhere unless we change the scenario. So let's do that. What if he's a dead guy laying face down and he's in a pool of his own blood, center torso? It's not around his head. It's center torso. So we're going to add that piece of information. This is another piece of evidence we're going to add to our scene. So let's put it on this part of our list. Now we can look over here and ask the question, well, can I rule out anything? Can I cross out anything? Given what I have now, this pool of blood around his center torso, what do you guys think? Natural, right? Because, I mean, if it was around his head, he might have had an aneurysm, hit the deck, bled out through his nose or his mouth. That's not where the blood is. The blood's around his torso. What part of your center torso could you bleed from naturally, right? Now, again, anything is possible, but not everything is reasonable. And that's why the standard of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt, not beyond a possible doubt, right? Because I can always raise some possible doubt. But here, I think we can cross out natural, because that doesn't seem to be reasonable. Can I cross out anything else? I need to kind of roll him over, don't I, to see what the injury is first? Let's change this scenario. What if he's a dead guy laying face down in a pool of his own blood center torso, but he also happened to have a gunshot wound in his back? It's an exit wound. Let's add that to our list. Now, can I cross out anything? This is the audience participation part of the presentation. This is like a room full of cops, okay? I swear. Could I cross out anything? No, right? Because these are all still in play. He could have accidentally shot himself, could have still been murdered, could have committed suicide. Let's change the scenario. What if next to his body I had on a piece of paper that I find elsewhere in the room, in his own handwriting, I have a suicide note? The only skin cell transfer, the only fingerprints on the paper are his. Let's put that in place. Now I have to add this piece of information. Okay. Can I cross anything out? I think I can cross out accidental. I mean, he may have accidentally killed himself before he intended to kill himself, but it appears from the note that he intended to kill himself. I can cross that out. But I think now, this is where I usually will ask audiences who are not cops, are we good to go? This is a suicide? What would you guys think? No, there's some doubt still, right? Because somebody could have forced him to write that note. There's all kinds of these weird criminal mind scenarios that people like, right? So let's go ahead and change it. What if, let's go back, I changed and added some scenarios. What if instead of a single gunshot wound, I had multiple gunshot wounds to his upper back? What if they were not exit wounds, they were entry wounds? What if there was a note, but the note is not written in his handwriting? It's not on a piece of paper I find anywhere else in the room. It's got an unknown fingerprint, an unknown DNA, an unknown handwriting on it. What if there was bloody footprints leading out of the room? That would change things. Would you agree? Let's put those things in place. There they are. You can tell this is a Southern California murder. Right? It's always 75 and drying in Southern California. But let's just add those dimensions. We've got footprints and fingerprints and all that. Great. So let's put that on our list. Okay. Can I cross out suicide now? I think so. This is now the most reasonable inference from evidence because we... Now, by the way, this is a process that all of you have been doing at death scenes, whether you ever thought about it or not. This is the same thing we ask jurors to do in criminal trials. This is called abductive reasoning. Abductive reasoning, or inferring to the most reasonable explanation. We do it all the time. I'm going back to this podium as if my laptop is here. Yeah, it's not here. But now the question is, could we change the scenario slightly? We did something else you may not have noticed. And it's a skill set that most of us have as homicide detectives working these kinds of death scenes. Here it is. You ready? Simple, simple statement. If I can explain everything that's in the room by staying in the room, it's probably not a homicide. If I can explain everything that's in the room with this guy by staying in the room, let me illustrate it by just kind of making the scenario a little bit clearer. Let's say we had him make the room a box. He's in the box now. Okay, here he is. In the box. We're going to play this little game of inside or outside the room. So, for example, if I look at that note and I say, well, gosh, it's written on a piece of paper that is got his handwriting. I find the paper elsewhere in the room. I find another pen like that elsewhere in the room. It's only got his fingerprints and his DNA on it. It clearly, I can explain the note by he alone can do that in the room without any help from anybody else. This is best now explained by staying in the room. If it's a single gun, if I interview people and they say, oh yeah, he's owned that gun for years. He keeps it in the safe in the corner of the room. He loves that gun. And it's registered to him and only his, you know, skin cell transfer is on it. I mean, it's now I can explain that gun by staying inside the room. It's his gun. And anyone can shoot themselves once without any help by staying alone in the room. I can even explain the gunshot wound if it's a single gunshot wound. And if that's the case, it's going to be one of these three. Of course, it's not going to be a natural. It's going to be an accidental or a suicide. But if the best explanation for the stuff in the room is a cause outside the room, everything changes, right? So, for example, if I look and I see, hey, you know, that's not his DNA, that's not his fingerprint, that note is nowhere else to be found, there's no paper like it anywhere in the room, unknown fingerprints on it, unknown DNA on it, well, okay, now I've got the best explanation is a cause that's not in the room. Also, the gun. If I interview them, the guy says, oh yeah, he's afraid of guns. He's never owned a gun. Never seen that gun. And it's not registered. It's either been removed or it's registered to somebody who doesn't live there. Either way, the best explanation now for the gun is outside the room. And it's kind of hard to shoot yourself multiple times in the back. better explanation is probably something other than you. And finally, I've got bloody footprints you can barely see there, and those are best explained by a cause outside the room. If the best explanation for the stuff that's in the room is a cause outside the room, everything shifts toward homicide. And why does that happen? Because now we've got evidence of an intruder. And intruders change everything. Intruders are the very thing that turn death scenes into crime scenes. If you've got no intruder and you got there, it's a suicide. Right? So this is what we're doing, is we're looking and seeing. Also, by the way, if you thought I might have been curious about why someone would kill themselves or why they might die accidentally, but once you know you've got an intruder, that sense of curiosity has to shift into a sense of urgency, right? Because we know faster is better than slower. This is why my cases that are from 1972 to 1990 are harder to solve, right? Because they're old and time has gone by. So if I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, okay, here I was, a guy who was reading through the Gospels, and I rejected the Gospels because they included supernatural elements, and I was very much a committed philosophical naturalist. I didn't believe that anything supernatural is involved in history, is involved in science, is involved in the universe. I believed that everything could be explained with nothing more than space, time, matter, physics, and chemistry. That's where I stood for a number of years. Well, could we take this approach, not just with this death scene, could we take this approach with the entire known universe? And if we did, what would that look like? In other words, can we stay inside the room of the natural universe to explain everything that we find in the room of the natural universe? Or are the better explanations for the stuff in the room a cause outside the room? It seems to me you could take the same approach to the universe. An inside or outside the room approach. Now, I think there are actually eight things in the universe that have to be explained, eight pieces of evidence. I'm not going to cover all of them with you this morning. If you needed evidence that God exists, well, I could spend the entire day covering all this stuff, but I'm not going to. Therefore, God exists. Okay, for most of you, you're thinking, thank God. If there is a God, thank him that he's not going to spend. I do this class at Biola, and it takes me 17 hours to teach it at the master's level. We're going to do a little short version of just a couple of pieces of evidence here, okay? But I want to tell you what these evidences are. First of all, we're in a universe that has a beginning. Did you realize that? That's not a claim from Scripture. By the way, well, I won't mention any Scripture in this talk to you today. I didn't care about Scripture. Don't try to make a case for your stupid God from your stupid Bible. Sorry. That doesn't get it done for me. You needed to make this case without any Scripture, which we will do. But we are in a universe that has a beginning, and science tells us that all space, time, and matter came into existence from nothing at a point in the distant past called a cosmic singularity. This is called a standard cosmological model. It's also called Big Bang cosmology. But Big Bang cosmology says that space, time, and matter did not always exist. It began to exist with the beginning of the universe, but that means whatever causes the universe cannot be spatial, temporal, or material. Am I stretching your mind a little bit so far? The point is, if all that we know as nature is space, time, and matter, we already have to step outside of nature to explain how the universe begins, because whatever starts it is not spatial, temporal, or material. Also, there is fine-tuning in the universe. The cosmological constants are incredibly fine-tuned on a hair's edge for the existence of carbon-based life like ours. Any small change of just the smallest difference in weak nuclear force, strong nuclear force, electromagnetic force, all of these forces, you can't even have a universe that is sustained, let alone life in the universe. And life comes into existence from nothing. Inorganic matter becomes living organic material. Believe me, they've been trying to explain that for about 55, 60 years. It's called Origin of Life Studies, OOLs, and they are not closer to getting an answer. The more we learn about life, the further we are from the answer. And the life that is here has the appearance of design. Even a staunch atheist like a guy like Richard Dawkins, who's an evolutionary biologist, would say that all of biology is the study of those things that appear to have been designed for a purpose. No kidding. But he's not a believer. Not only that, you're thinking about this right now, and you're using your conscious mind to do that. Where does that come from? If all we have in the universe is stuff, matter, that means you might have a brain, but this immaterial thing you're calling your mind makes no sense in a universe that is dominated by matter only. This is why these folks call this the problem of mind. Why is it a problem? Because evolution works on matter, but it can't work on immaterial things. How do we get to minds? And you have freedom. You can actually decide if I'm making the right statement or a false statement. You're free to choose that. But if you're just matter, you don't have that kind of freedom because you're just another domino falling because a prior domino fell against you. That means that every decision you thought you were making freely, you didn't make freely. Sam Harris, the neuroscientist who's an atheist philosopher, he says you don't have the freedom you think you have because your thoughts are just the conclusion, the result of neurons firing in your brain, causing other neurons to fire, and you have no control over any of those neurons. That's what physicalism is called determinism, and atheism does. It denies free agency. It denies mind. And today we're going to talk about two more, objective moral truths and the problem of evil, which I won't get into too much detail because we're going to go into those now. Two of these are entirely cosmological, two are biological, two are mental, and two are moral. This is why this case is so strong. It's built on so many different kinds of evidence, all of which point to the same causal cause, same first cause. So let's take a look at some of this right now. We're going to start, and I do think that the best explanation is not found inside the room. You can't get those eight things with just space, time, matter, physics, and chemistry. The best explanation is actually outside the room, a cause outside of space, time, matter, physics, and chemistry. So let's just jump into it. What we're going to do, by the way, this is, if that's the case, and you've got an outside cause, isn't this another form of intruder? Investigation. And only this intruder spans the entire cosmos, which is why I called that book God's Crime Scene, not because I was suggesting that God has committed a crime. I'm suggesting you could investigate the universe like a crime scene. So we started with this template. We made a list of evidences, a list of explanations. We're now going to turn a corner and look at the universe. These are the evidences we're going to list, those eight things we just talked about. We're only going to cover two today. And the only two possible explanations for this is some set of forces inside the room or some set of forces outside the room. Which is the better explanation? We're just doing a little bit of abductive reasoning here. And we're going to start right here. Look, Jim just talked about ethics and integrity and morality. Who cares what Jim says about ethics, integrity, or morality? Honestly, who gives a lick about what he says about any of that stuff? Is it just his personal opinion? What if your opinion says, well, I can have integrity in this area of my life, but I don't need to have integrity in that area of my life? Well, that kind of defies the idea of integrity. But the point is, couldn't you argue that? I mean, it's just he has his view of morals, you have your view of morals. Each of us is raised in different environments. We learn from our parents. Our parents held the different values. So we need to think about whether or not there are objective, transcendent moral values that apply to all of us. A number of years, I worked gangs in Los Angeles County, and I met people who were just the most interesting people. They were all gangsters. And some of these guys, you know, if you've ever worked gangsters, you know that these guys have a code that they apply to their own lives. It's not like these guys are valueless. It's not like these guys don't have a moral code. They do have a moral code. I had a case one time where this guy, Jesse, had his sister had been fronted by a rival gang member who had said some rather sexually provocative things to her. So Jesse captured this guy and tortured him to death, slowly, over the course of an entire day. Now, afterwards, when asked about it, he's like, hey, dude should have known. If I'd have done that to his sister, I would expect him to do that to me. He clearly had a code that he was putting in place. It's not our code, but it seemed right to him. And by the way, his group affirmed it. They felt the same way. So I thought, well, gosh, isn't that interesting? So it kind of feels to him like, why are you, Officer Wallace, applying your code to me? I have a different code. Just because you happen to be in charge? Because you happen to be wearing a badge? Well, is that, I could say that. I say, yeah, as a matter of fact, that's exactly why I get to do this. No, but that doesn't seem to be satisfactory, does it, really? How do I teach my kids? As long as there's a code in place, does that make it cool? Well, he had a code in place. Does that make it right? I don't think so. So let's just take a look at this academically for a second. Here's a line. These are illustrations from the book God's Crime Scene. I kind of think there's a moral legal hierarchy here. So Jesse comes up, and he's got himself a code. Now, what makes his code right? He's got his personal beliefs. Are moral truths grounded in persons? I don't think they are, right? Because if that was the case, and you had a moral belief, and you had a different moral belief, you could never say his moral belief was wrong. No, moral beliefs comes from people. I'm a different person than you. Therefore, you could never judge my moral belief if moral beliefs are grounded in people like Jesse. So we already know that won't get it done. Because there's all kinds of nut jobs we work with all the time, right? And they have their own moral beliefs. Well, maybe it's a group. Like, Jesse's got a group. He's got his gang. It seems to me that his gang has authority over, he has to bend his knee to his gang's moral group. But do groups like Jesse's gang get to decide what's morally virtuous and morally vile? I don't think so, right? They can't even agree with other gang groups. And by the way, they still can't park their car anywhere they want in Los Angeles because we have a city code. So it seems to me that our municipal code kind of trumps, you got to bend your knee to our code. But do all moral truths come from cities? We have different city codes in Los Angeles than we do in Santa Barbara or San Diego. And you can't say one is right or wrong if they all just come from cities. Actually, there are state legislation, state codes, penal codes that apply to all of us. So you could argue that the state is where all moral truths. Really? So if the state says it's okay to do something, does that make it really okay? Is it okay? Is legal the same as moral? It's legal to commit adultery. Does that make it moral? I don't think we can say that moral truths are even grounded in state codes. Are they grounded in federal law? Well, there's lots of federal laws right now that you would say are immoral. We're killing millions of infants before they're born every year. Now, I'm not saying I have a view on that. But even if you don't agree with my view on that, would you at least agree that not every federal law is going to make it moral? So maybe it's something bigger than that. Maybe the United Nations gets to decide this. God, I hope not. But if it did, right? Because it seems to me if I look at this hierarchy, that as you go up, these people have jurisdiction over a lot of what's below them, or they'd like to at least. I think we would say no, right? Nations don't make things right. If nations decide what's right or wrong, then we can't argue with World War II Germany, right? As a matter of fact, at Nuremberg, they argued that states are what make things right. Did you realize at Nuremberg, they brought the captains up, the people who were leading the concentration camps, they brought them to trial, an international tribunal. And those captains in World War II said, hey, you can't prosecute and execute us just because you guys are the winners. In our culture, this was affirmed. We were promoted for this behavior. I grew up this way. This is what was told was the right thing for us to do. Now, you want to come along with your set of rules and apply them to us? No. You can't do that just because you're the winner. In our culture, this was okay when we did it. Therefore, you have to accept that this was okay. Did we do that? No, we executed every one of those knuckleheads. Because the guy who was the Chief Justice from the United States, actually, a guy named Jackson, said that there is a law above the law. That's what we're looking for here. We're looking to see, is there a law above the law? I think there is. How high does it go? I think if there were planets, if there's a Star Trek universe out there, there are some things you should not do to the Klingons or the Romulans. Because there's a law that even transcends all of us as people groups on different planets. For example, should you ever torture babies for the fun of it? No. Not even Klingon babies. So how high does this go? And if it goes that high, what is the source? What is the cause up there that would explain it? This rule is true for everyone. Even if Jesse doesn't agree, he was torturing that guy for the fun of it. Didn't make it right because he thought it was okay. We see this law as an objective, transcendent law that applies to all of us, even if nations didn't agree. So what is the source of these kinds of objective, transcendent laws? If they can't be grounded in any of the institutions of man, how do we ground them? You may have noticed something here. All of these seem to be insufficient. None of these get the job done. And that's the problem. We would hope that these man-made institutions would not be the source of moral law. Because if that's the case, you already see from world wars and from all kinds of other things, that doesn't work. We're looking for that. What transcends all of us? Now, you may have noticed something here. All of these are people groups. Did you notice that? This is a people group. People group. People group, people group, people group. Why is that the case? Because we are not obligated to anything other than people. It's not just that there are moral laws, like you should never torture babies for the fun of it. These are moral obligations between persons. Ever think about that? Here's what I mean. I am not morally obligated to my police car. None of you are. I'm not morally obligated to this framed proclamation. I'm morally obligated to the passenger sitting next to me in the police car. I'm not morally obligated to my flashlight, but I am morally obligated to the people in my community. I'm not morally obligated to physics. If physics was the cause of everything in the universe, why would you feel moral obligations? You're not obligated to the law of gravity. Sorry, you're not. You can do whatever you want. You can defy it. I'm defying it right now. See? I'm not obligated to it. Because it's not a person. We are obligated always to persons. That's the nature of moral obligations. Here's my point. If we are morally obligated only to persons, what is the objective, transcendent, moral person we feel obligated to? It can't be physics. It has to be a person. Now, what do you do with this? I think this is good evidence that we have to get outside the room. And this is what Richard Dawkins, who does not believe in Christianity or any kind of theism, says, hey, if there is no God, the universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there's at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. That's right. If the universe is governed by physics alone and there is no personal source of authority for moral obligations, then that is true. The universe doesn't give a lick about you. Physics don't care about you or what you guys do to each other. Those kinds of obligations you feel, which are part of the human condition, can only come from one source. They can't come from physics. So there's a couple of ways that people try to stay inside the room of the universe to explain objective moral truths. They'll say they come from persons or from person groups. But we already know these things don't work, because if that was the case, now the other way they'll say is somehow they don't exist at all. There are no moral truths. And a lot of atheists who are consistent in their worldview will say this. No, you've invented these little fictional things that help you live, but there really are no objective moral truth claims. So you're saying that it's not objectively true that you shouldn't torture babies for the fun of it? Yes, they'll say yes. Really? Then you got a bigger problem than rejecting moral truths. You got a moral problem that's much deeper if you think that's actually okay. So it turns out these things would keep you in the room, but they don't work. Let's illustrate it another way. So here's the universe. If we're going to stay inside the room, we have one of these three ways to do it. But each one of these has its own impossible death knell failure. There's another way to get moral truth, so. Objective moral truth. It could just be that they are caused, not by these three groups, but they are grounded in an objective, transcendent moral being. But that means we'd have to jump outside the room, because this is not physics and chemistry anymore. This is a being that is outside, transcends everything in the room. And that's why we feel these objective, transcendent moral truths, because this is the source. And if you look at that, that makes much better sense. This philosopher, who's pretty good about this kind of stuff, says science is about facts, not norms. It might tell us how we are, but it couldn't tell us what is wrong with how we are. There couldn't be a science of the human condition. That's exactly right. Now, if there is a suspect outside the room that is a personal source of all moral law, that would explain what we see inside the room. Let's go one more step. You talked about this one. I want to talk about this one, because most of us deal with this every day. And for a lot of us, this is the best evidence against the existence of God. Right? There's an all-powerful, all-loving God, yet we just had how many hurricanes? We just had a shooting in Las Vegas. How many people died? Where is your God? Why would God allow, if there is a God, allow such a thing? Now, how many of you here in this room work homicides? Raise your hand. Come on, raise your hand. You can do this. Okay, a few of you do. Okay, great. So I want to show you, I get these questions all the time. This is a case from 19, it was my oldest case. This is a 1972 case. This is my dad. He hates that picture, which is why I show it all the time, because I think it's funny. He's got this polyester suit on. It's so ridiculous. Look at that tie. That is hideous. Do you know my brother actually got married in that suit like 20 years later? My dad doesn't throw anything away. He bought that at Sears. I was with him when he bought it. Okay? He also hates this because he's got his greasy 1972 haircut there. He's got that cop mustache thing going. He hates it. By the way, nobody wears just a mustache anymore. Have you noticed that? If you're going to have facial hair, you either have no facial hair or you have a beard or a goatee. Very few people have just a mustache. So if you have just a mustache, I want you to raise your hand. Raise your hand right now. Raise it. How many of you have just mustache? Okay, take a look. Old guys. That's my whole point. That's my whole point. Someone did not send them the telegram, okay? Shave that thing off before you leave here today. That's ridiculous, okay? That's what it looks like. Also, he hates this picture because it looks like his butt's sticking out right there. That's actually his gun, but he is, you know, who knows that? This is from our paper called The Daily Breeze. This dude here had confessed in a really hideous, gruesome confession to killing a 10-year-old girl on a holiday in our city. Everything in that confession, 1,000 pages of everything he did to her and then how he finally killed her. He's not the killer. He lied about all of it. He confessed it to this detective and this detective with the cool sideburn here. None of it's true. It's still an open case. But afterwards, I remember my first case I opened as a cold case detective, and I went and talked to the family. And the first question you think they had was what? Why? Why? How could this horrific thing happen to our daughter, Jackie? Well, okay. Good question. I think we see those kinds of questions as cops. But I think you and I know that the answers to difficult questions are never easy. So I have to put it this way. Well, okay, Jackie was the kind of girl who would get into a car. If she wasn't the kind of girl who would get into a car, she wouldn't have gotten into that car that day. But she was so gregarious. And this is 1972, and we're in a pocket of our city where she just didn't see that coming. And so she got into the car. So that's the first condition that has to be in place for this crime to occur. Also, it was on a holiday, and they told her, get out of the house. We're cooking dinner. Don't come back in this house until we call you back in this house. And they weren't paying attention to what Jackie was doing. If they hadn't been paying attention, and if she hadn't been the kind of person who would get into a car, this crime doesn't occur. And not only that, the person who did this to her, I guarantee you, had some kind of disturbing upbringing of his own. Because most of these guys we work who are pedophiles, these guys have had their own bad experience. If he doesn't have that kind of upbringing, she isn't that kind of girl who gets into a car and it's not a holiday, this doesn't happen. It was also an unusual part of our city. He had to know enough about our city to even know this neighborhood existed. If he doesn't know that, isn't that kind of person, she isn't getting a car, and it's not a holiday, this doesn't happen. Do you see what's happening here? There's a number of effects, number of cause and effect relationships that made this happen. If he doesn't have the right kind of car, if he doesn't have an idea of where to take her and how much time it was going to take to do this crime, all of these things together help explain. By the way, I don't even know what the relationships are between all. As a detective, my job is to figure out what are the conditions, who meets these conditions. That will explain this single act of evil. Any act of evil is explained this way. Does that make sense? This is what we do in investigations, right? We're trying to re-puzzle. And they're never easy. So let's go ahead and take a look at the case that I showed you earlier for the existence of God. We talked about transcendent moral truths. I think that all of these things are best explained by a creator God outside the room. I think they are. And anytime we have evidence that points to a conclusion positively, we call that inculpating evidence. But now we have this new element to be discussed, evil. And the question is, where do we put evil? Do we put evil, is that point to God, or does that really point away from God? If it points away from God, we call that exculpating evidence, kind of like someone having an alibi. You might think he's your guy and everything lines up perfectly, but he was in France on the day of the murder. That is what exculpates him. He is no longer your suspect. Does this happen with evil and injustice? Are these the kinds of things that demonstrate that God couldn't exist? Here's why I say that. Let's take a look at this argument here, basically. This is from an ancient philosopher named Epicurus. And here's what he said. Is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he's not omnipotent. Is he able but not willing? Then he's malevolent. Is he both able and willing? Then whence cometh evil? Is he neither able nor willing? Then why call him God? Let me give it to you in English. Is he not able to stop evil? Then stop calling him all-powerful. Is he not willing to stop evil? Then stop calling him all-loving. If he's all-powerful and all-loving, why do we have evil at all? Best explanation is there's no God. And so he would use this as an argument against God. I want to offer for you a template that I think explains why we have evil in the world. The same way those six conditions had to be met for Jackie to die, I think there are six or seven things that might explain why God, an all-powerful, all-loving God, would allow an act of evil, the kinds of acts of evil that we get to work every day. I think it comes down to several things: an accurate view of eternity, a definition of free agency and love, and also what role it plays in character development and calling people to himself, in the nature of justice and mercy, and finally, our limited understanding. Let me show it to you quickly. Here we go. The first thing you have to remember, I think, is that eternity changes everything in how you've been thinking about this. If you're not a Christian in this room, you're not somebody who believes in God in this room, then you're where I was for many years, because as an atheist, I had a problem with the problem of evil. Why? Because I believed that all life was a line segment from birth to death, and I wanted to get 90 pain-free years between these two points. As a matter of fact, I don't even want to start to decay. I just want to one day have a stroke or die in my sleep, right? And I wanted 90 years because most of my family lives a long time. So if God is good, if life is good, forget about God. If life is good, I'm going to get 90. Now, listen, if I get sick, say at the age of 40, and I have a protracted battle with cancer and die at the age of 50, I'm going to be pissed, okay? I'm going to see that as evil. Why? Because I had an expectation, and now this 40 years I did not see coming. That was a painful 10 years there, right, from 40 to 50. And then I lost all of that. It turns out that all of evil is always determined and measured and considered in light of what you expected to happen. But what if I'm wrong? What if I'm wrong about the nature of life? As an atheist, this is what I thought life was. But I could be wrong about that foundationally. What if life is not a line segment but a ray? Starts at birth, ends at death, but then it extends beyond death, way out that for millions of miles, infinitely, eternally. Would that change the way I saw evil? There are people in this room right now who, as a baby, you had some surgery that was horrific. And it was painful, I'm sure. But you had to have it to correct some heart issue, whatever. But if I had stopped you right then and said, how's life going for you? You would have said, it sucks, okay? It's painful. This is terrible. Life is terrible. It's evil. That by the time you were like five, you couldn't even remember that you had been through that as an infant. Evil is always measured in the context of your experience. And by this time, you're already over it. Now, think about this. What if life is not a line segment, but a ray? Every year you're on the other side of the second dot, you're 100 years into eternity. As eternity stretches out in that direction, your experience here on earth is going to shrink by comparison. Follow me? Until finally, 1,000 years into eternity, 1,000,000 years into eternity, those 90 years you spent here are a millisecond. They don't even matter. You could have the worst, crappiest life in the world for 90 entire years, but it still would be like that little surgery you had as an infant compared to this. Do you see how eternity changes everything? Now, what happens is those of us who believe there is an eternity don't often live like there's an eternity, because the minute we have a problem, we bitch about it. Like, all we get to these 90 years. All I have is the next two. I got to do this today? Really? Yeah, really, because this is your life here. Keep it in mind. If we're going to live consistently, we have to live consistently in the way we think, our worldview. But also, we have to think about free agency and what that brings. We just had a spree of killings in Las Vegas. How do we explain that kind of moral evil? Well, a lot of it has to do with free agency. Right? Think about this for a second. If there is a loving God who creates a world, do you think he would want to create a world in which love is possible or a world in which love is impossible? It seems to me if there is a loving God, he wants to create a world in which love is possible. Really? You want that kind of world? That's a crappy, scary world. You know that, right? Let's say, for example, I separated from my wife. We got married on Valentine's Day. What if I separated from my wife, and on Valentine's Day the next year I wanted to reunite with her, so I sent her this card in an effort to reunite with her? You will love me. Roses are red, bullets are lead, take me back now or get shot in the head. That's a pretty cool card, would you agree? How effective do you think that would be with my wife? Probably not all that effective, right? Why? Because you know that love is not coerced. You cannot program us to love. It's not really a, love has to be offered freely. It turns out the thing you need before you can have love is something scary. It's something called free agency. If you don't have free agency, you can't love. But free agency is super scary because it means that you have to have the freedom to hate as well as the freedom to love. It means you have to have a world in which you introduce scary things in order to get the thing that you know is beautiful. That makes sense? This kind of free agency is scary. Now, an unloving God would just say, okay, you know what? I'm just gonna create this scary thing called free agency. I'm going to throw the knife at you. I'm not even going to tell you how to catch it by the handle or the blade. That's not what God does, right? God doesn't just give us that scary free agency. What he does is he gives us directions on how to use that scary free agency. This is a scary place otherwise, right? But he's given us a set of guidelines how, so we won't mishandle the blade. We won't mishandle the knife. He's given us a set of commandments. Now, we could choose to ignore the commandments, but that's not on him. He's given us the scary thing that has great potential, and he's given us guidelines on how to use the scary thing that has great potential. We often misuse it. But that's not on God. Free agency does have to be considered. Let's go one more. We have a definition of love. We think of love in the way that Hollywood thinks of love, which is stupid. I mean, honestly, when you think of love, you probably think of these words. Am I right? These come to mind. Love, kindness, gentleness, adoration, affection. These are the things we think about in love. Now, if you're a parent in this room, you know there's a dimension of love I have not listed. Right? That's called tough love. It goes on the bottom. This is what C.S. Lewis, maybe some of you are familiar with his work. He wrote a book called Mirror Christianity. I love this quote. He says, what we want, in fact, is not so much a father in heaven as a grandfather in heaven. You know, a senile benevolence who, as they say, liked to see young people enjoying themselves and whose plan for the universe was simply that it might be truly said at the end of each day, a good time was had by all. That is not God. That is not your father. That's your grandfather for sure, but that is not your father. And that's what we have to deal with here, right? Is what role does God play? Let's go back to our timeline for a second. So it turns out that, you know, we have this life, this temporal life, and then we have this eternal life. Another way of saying it is you have this earthly life, and you have this post-earthly life. Now, in the earthly life you have right now, you have a set of parents. They love you. And they might allow you to, you know, undergo some moment of pain when they got your inoculations, when you had your surgery, when they didn't pay for your car to get fixed, because they're trying to accomplish something good over here. And while you're over here, you're going, this stinks! But they, you know, years later when you look back at it, you go, that was probably a good thing. Now, if you do have a heavenly parent, a heavenly father, this would change things. He's not in control of this life. He's in control of all of this. Now, being in control of all of that, he might allow you some suffering over here. You might say, well, yeah, but I knew him till he died. That thing ruined his entire life. I didn't see anything good come out of that. Well, yeah, stupid, because you're looking over on these 90 years. God is not limited to those 90 years. He might want to achieve something over here. Makes sense, right? It's our definition of what love is that I think changes everything. He's in charge of all of it. And by the way, love doesn't care about your comfort. God cares about your character, the stuff that goes long, not the stuff that's short. One more. This I used to think would drive me crazy as an atheist. You want to tell me that you think God is using what happened on Sunday night to develop character? That's a stupid, lame. You could do it some other way, couldn't you? Now, as an atheist, I would have told you there were several things that I wanted to see in my world that I held at a high value, even though I was not a believer. These, for example, were things that, as an atheist, I would have said were high moral values. Really? You want to create a world in which that stuff's reasonable, that actually exists? How do you think you get that stuff in the world? Do you think you just snap your fingers and your kids have courage? Do you think you put on that uniform and it gives you courage? No. Courage is a response to something. Courage is developed in the face of danger. No danger, you won't get courage. So if I want to develop courage in you, I've got to put you and test you in danger. Oh, you want to have compassion toward people? Well, then I've got to put you in front of suffering. Because compassion is a response to something. It's not like a magic wave your wand. This is how you get compassion. This is how you get forgiveness. This is how you get sacrifice, how you get charity. So it turns out if you wanted all those good things in your world, you'd have to design a world like this, which is exactly what we see. So yeah, God has a desire for those high values, those high moral virtues. But you know, this is why, for example, I never, ever, ever pray for patience. Why would you pray for patience? If you pray for patience, what's God going to do? Give you something to test your patience. Forget about patience. I don't even want it. Let's go back to this one here. This is what Lewis says about this. To ask that God's love should be content with us as we are is to ask that God should cease to be God. Because he is what he is, his love must, in the nature of things, be impeded and repelled by certain stains in our present character. And because he already loves us, he must labor to make us lovable. That labor we're going through, it hurts. But it's making us lovable. Well, how about this? The power to draw us. Look, when I was not a Christian, not even a believer in God, I would have said, hey, if God wants me, he can get me pretty easily. All he has to do is reach out to me. Just come and get me. Well, really? I think he was trying. And everything he sent my way, I found a way to ignore. I mean, he gave me an entire thing called a Bible. I never bought one until I was 35. I was working surveillance at the time. I spent 10 hours a day in a car following bad guys, listening to the radio. Do you know how much public radio there is in California that's all Christian? Skip. Didn't want to hear any of that junk. I found a way to ignore everything and everyone he sent to me with this message. Really? Well, if you won't come this way, he could get you another way, right? But you won't like that way because that way is how he pushes us. And sometimes he pushes us through acts of evil that make us consider him for the first time. Because what he wants to do is to get us to pay attention. And if you're stuck in your stuff, you're not paying attention. You're not. When we're happy, you don't pay attention. What team has ever developed character through winning? If you're winning right now, you're not paying attention. A few losses, you'll start paying attention. This is what Lewis says about this. He says, let me implore the reader to try to believe, if only for the moment, that God, who made these deserving people, may really be right when he thinks that their modest prosperity and the happiness of their children are not enough to make them blessed, so that all of this must fall from them in the end. That's right. Once what stuff has been taken away from you, you start to pay attention. Don't wait that long. A couple more things here. This relationship between love and justice, I think we should get above all else as cops, right? We should get this. That there is a relationship between these two things, which is inextricable. And here it is. We have an all-loving God. An all-loving God cannot be loving unless he's just. Can't be. Oh, David, my son David, we're out driving in the car. David, I love you. I can't believe how well you've turned out. I think the world of you. Now, he might look at that and say, wow, what a loving statement. Now, if the next time I stop at the corner, there's a bank robber coming out of the bank. The alarms are sounding, the shots are fired, and I stop the bank robber. I say, bank robber, I love you. I'm so proud of how you turned out. I think the world of you. If I tell him the same thing I just told my son, that my son knows, he doesn't mean that. He's not just about who he dispenses his mercy to. He's not just about who he directs his words to. He'll say that to anybody. And if that's the case, your justice, your love, is pretty much meaningless unless you are just about how it's dispensed. Does that make sense? So in the end, I would say a loving God has to be a just God, and there are three forms of justice that most of us as parents get. Let me remind you of these three forms of justice because they are in our criminal system. The first one is called retributive justice, and that's about being I do this with my kids sometimes. You did that yesterday. That made me so mad. I'm just going to punish you for it. How many times have you, a parent, done that? You're just mad about yesterday. I do this all the time. A better form might be the second kind, which is called utilitarian justice, which is not about punishing for the past as much as it's about punishing for the future. Look, you did that yesterday. I wish you hadn't done that, but here's my bigger concern. If you continue to do this downfield, you're going to be a train wreck. I'm going to punish you right now. Not about yesterday. I'm punishing you right now so you won't do this again. That's a very different approach to justice. Would you agree? Third is called restorative justice, and that's simply that we do this also in criminal trials where we want to recompensate people, victims, for things that have been done to them. Look, we see this form of justice in our own lives as parents. Why would we think it'd be any different for God? Wouldn't God also be involved in these three forms of justice? Because this is what loving parents do. Last thing. You think, really, that you could actually understand this to begin with? We're just humans trying to understand what God's plans are, what is he's trying to achieve 1,000 years downfield. How would we even know that? We're just humans. Let's go to our timeline again one more time. So here's our timeline. Oh, first of all, Epicurus. Let's just talk about the way he poses this complaint about God. It's so wonderful how he does it. He's very clever. He says, look, is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he's not omnipotent. Is he able but not willing? Then he's malevolent. The first part of this, he is complaining about God and his all-powerful nature. Is he just not able to do it? Well, he's not all-powerful. In the second line, he's complaining about God's all-loving nature. Is he just not willing to do it? Then he's not all-loving. Now, if this is where it actually stopped, I could see why the complaint makes sense. But this is not the definition of God as you know it as a Christian. There are attributes of God. These are only two. It turns out there's a significant third attribute that solves the dilemma. And by the way, I think Epicurus knew that. That's why he left it out. So this seems powerful. The third attribute, of course, is the all-knowing nature of God. Right? Now we can go to our timeline. So it turns out this is our temporal life here. This is the stuff that we know about, but clearly God would know about a lot more. Right? He would know that if I change this little detail, the ripple effect 25 years from now is important to me. Something good can come of this evil that might affect millions, although today it's going to harmfully affect 10. That butterfly effect in the future, only God would know. This is why I think this is a great quote from a Franciscan monk. No, it's a Dominican priest. I was close. If God would concede me his omnipotence for 2 hours, you would see how many changes I would make in the world. Oh, but if he gave me his wisdom too, I would leave things as they are. I think you would too. Because only God knows what he's really trying to do downfield. So here's my point. If you look at all of this collectively, these are the 7 things that I think would cause God to allow any event that we would call evil. Now, of course, I don't know what the percentages are. In any particular act, I can't tell you what his major cause is, what his minor causes are. I can't even tell you what the relationships are between the major and minor causes. I can't be the mind of God. But I do know that those are the 7 things he's probably thinking about. And that would explain any act of evil. But let me just leave you with one last thing before we break. Why are we calling this evil to begin with? It goes back to our first part of the talk. Is it because you don't like it? You don't like what happened in Vegas? Is it evil because it makes you mad? Or it makes you sad? Is it the way you feel that makes it evil? Is evil something that's a matter of personal opinion? Some people see it as evil, some people don't. Is that what makes it evil? No, we think that was truly evil. I don't care who you are. That was wrong. Really? Well, if you think it's a matter of more than your personal opinion, by the way, if it's just your personal opinion, you could remove all evil tomorrow. Just change your mind. All goes away. Doesn't work that way, huh? Because evil, if we're talking about true evil, transcends your personal opinion. Also, the opinion of this group or this nation. Do you see where we're headed with this? If there's true evil, it has to be grounded in something bigger. Well, Lewis was an atheist for a number of years, and his chief argument against God was the problem of evil in the universe, and this is what he said about it. My argument against God was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. How had I got this idea of just and unjust, though? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing the universe with when I called it unjust? In other words, if there is not a standard, an objective, transcendent standard for good by which we measure anything and call it evil, then all evil is simply a matter of opinion. But we don't think it's a matter of opinion. The shadow, evil, requires the sunshine. And what does that look like? Well, and again, this ends up being an evidence not against God. We could say, well, I think that God's the best explanation. Oh, no, there's evil in the universe. There can be no God. No, actually, there can be no true evil unless there is a true standard of good called God by which you are measuring something and calling it evil. So it turns out that evil is yet another evidence of God. Because the only way to get transcendent objective evil in the universe is to base it, to ground it in a standard of objective good that's outside the universe. Make sense? So in the end, evil, if you were to ask me what's the best evidence for God's existence, I'm going to say it's evil. You can't have true evil if there's no God. Of course, I could have given up my idea of justice by saying it was nothing but a private idea of my own, an opinion. But if I did that, then my argument against God collapsed too, for the argument depended on saying that the world was really unjust, that there was true evil, not simply that it did not happen to please my private fancies, which is a nice British way of saying my personal opinion. In the end, if there is a source outside the universe, a standard of good by which we could define evil, that would explain everything. Now, that being said, let me show you where we're at. We started with this concept of inside or outside the room. And I think that given what we have, we knew there was good evidence for an intruder. And intruders turn death scenes into crime scenes. I get that. Also, they give us a sense of urgency. Okay. Now we turn this corner, and we're going to talk about this in terms of the universe. Inside or outside the room. These are drawings from the book, by the way. I have a weird background. I wasn't always a cop. I was an architect until I was 27. And then I became a cop. So I get to illustrate my own books, which is kind of saves me a few dollars. So these are the illustrations from the book. I think in the end that these are best explained not outside. You can't get these eight things with space, time, and matter inside the room. The best explanation is outside the room. Now, this would give us an idea of what our suspect looks like, right? We have not touched any scripture. But every time you work at a death scene, a crime scene, I know something about the guy I'm going to arrest, even before I meet him, right? Because I can assemble a suspect profile just from the stuff that's in the crime scene. You're right? If a guy is killed at a 7-Eleven, he's shot in the back of the head, and there's $50 missing from the till, that's one kind of killer, right? If the same guy is killed in his bedroom, stabbed 70 times in the groin on his bed, different kind of killer, would you agree? Which of those two killers probably knows him intimately? 70 times in the groin. So now my case is not the entire world could have killed him, it's a very small group who would know him that intimately. Much easier case to work the second one, right? Same thing happens here. I've got a suspect. I can actually develop a profile based on what? Based on the things I learn from each piece of evidence. Now, I don't think it's Mick Jagger, okay? Although he's been arrested his fair share of times, okay? And why? Because he doesn't fit the description I would need. I'm looking for something that's outside of space, time, and matter, that is so purposeful it could fine-tune the universal constants in the universe to get life to appear, that is the intelligent source for the information in DNA, which starts life, and then is the designer behind the design we see in biology, that is a mind with free agency that creates freely in its image other beings that have mind and free agency, and is even the source of all objective moral truths, and is the standard by which we would call anything evil. That is not Mick Jagger. But there is, of course, a suspect that would fit that bill, right? This is the classic definition of God that we see offered by really every group. By the way, my case today does not bring me to Christianity, because Yahweh fits that description, but I think that my Muslim friends would say that Allah also can fit that description. I would disagree in some ways, but still, the case could be made. I could use this book to make a case for Islam. The other book, Cold Case Christianity, makes the case for Christianity. But this book simply wants to move people to at least reconsider their philosophical naturalism. This is the guy we took to jail from a case in 1979. How did we get him there? We got him there on the basis of different kinds of evidence. We had some witnesses that told us some things about him. We had his own behaviors when he was a young man before he killed this woman. And we had some evidence at the crime scene. He killed her with a garrote, which is kind of a cool way to kill her. And then finally, we had some statements he made, which kind of gave himself away. Now, what's great about this kind of case is it's built on different forms of evidence with different kinds of experts. And anytime you have a cumulative case that is built on different forms of evidence, you probably have a good case. Now, something similar is happening here. We have these eight pieces of evidence. These experts here in cosmology are astrophysicists. They are completely unrelated to other forms of other kinds of experts. These folks down here in biology are either microbiologists, like my son David, or they are biochemists. These folks over here are folks who are usually people who are in neurosciences or philosophers, and finally you have ethicists and philosophers who work down in this category. It turns out that every one of these points to the same cause. When you have a case, you're building on 8 different pieces of evidence in 4 different disciplines that point to the same cause, you probably have the right guy. Now, interestingly, defense attorneys, you know how you've worked in cases, you know how good defense attorneys are. Oh, I can explain that some other way. I've got 4 possible explanations, and I can explain that with 3 possible explanations, and I can explain this with 4, and this with 5, and this with 4. And they'll offer a whole bunch of possible alternative explanations. I just did a case with Robert Shapiro, right, of O.J. Simpson fame, and we were in the same court that we did O.J. in. I'm telling you, this is what he does really well. Now, interestingly, these experts do not agree with each other. This guy says, oh, this guy's wrong. This guy says this guy's wrong. This guy says this guy's wrong. They don't agree. And none of these things are available to explain this piece of evidence. So now I need a set of what? 20, 30, 40, 50 amazing coincidences to explain these 8 pieces of evidence. That's one way to explain it. Now, there's another way to explain it, of course, and that's that there is one common causal suspect who not only explains all the evidence, but unifies it. He's the only explanation that's needed for all those pieces of evidence. Which of these two ways makes more sense? Which is more reasonable? Well, we would say that this, of course, is more reasonable. So for years, we've been looking for a theory of everything that will unify quantum physics with macro physics, you know, large-scale physics with small-scale physics. That theory of everything we're looking for, I'm here to tell you today, I've solved it. There is a theory of everything. It's called God. Because that's the one common causal suspect that would actually explain everything we see in the universe. That's why I wrote that book the way I wrote it. Make sense? I'm checking my prompter to see what's now. I'm going to leave you in a second for a little bit of a break, but I wanted to show you why I actually did this. This is the case I make for Christianity in Cold Case Christianity. It takes a long time to talk about this case. It's built on several. I call this Death by 1,000 Paper Cuts. It's built on thousands of pieces of evidence that all point to the reliability of the eyewitness accounts. Okay. But I would have said as an atheist, don't care. Take your stupid case and I don't want to hear it because I don't believe in anything supernatural. You want me to believe this Jesus guy did that. Sorry, I'm out. I don't believe in miracles. I don't believe in anything supernatural. Well, think about it. We just talked about the case from the universe. These evidences point to the best explanation as a creator God outside of space, time, or matter. In other words, we're looking for something as the creator of the universe that created everything. He's all-powerful. He's non-spatial. It's non-temporal, non-material. It's a first cause. If there is something out there that could blink the entire universe into existence from nothing, that's right, nothing, no space. There was no space before there was space. Space is not nothing. Space is something. We know from the science that space came into existence. So what is nothing if space isn't nothing? Well, nothing is what Aristotle said rocks dream about. Nothing, okay? So if there's a being out there that could do this, I'm thinking, okay, you know what? That's pretty amazing because it can't be space, time, or matter. It has to be extra natural. The only thing we identify as natural is space, time, and matter. So now we're looking for an extra natural. You might say a supranatural or a supernatural first cause. And if that's the case, if there's a being out there that could do that, I'm guessing he could probably do this. And that opened up everything for me. I already believed in something extra natural. Because I believed in Big Bang cosmology. The only difference was, is the first cause personal or impersonal? If it's personal, that's the only way to explain moral obligations. Then I'm stuck with all that. Pay no attention to my walking back here. So this is where I ended up. Now, we're going to take a break. But the reason why I wanted to offer this to you first, before we start talking about ethics and morality in our work, is because you know, if you've been doing this job long enough, that you consider the world divided into 2 groups, right? There's sheep and there are wolves. And you already know that. And we're here to do what? Protect the sheep from the wolves, right? And what are we described as in Scripture as Christians? Sheep. Is that a compliment? No, that's a pejorative. Sheep are dumb as a rock. Sheep are stupid. Okay, you know that, right? And they're dirty. And they have no idea they're being picked off by wolves. Every day they come back for the trough, they're like, hey, where's Jake? Jake was here yesterday. No Jake today. There's a big blood spot on the ground. I don't know. They're stupid. Now, there's another animal in the yard. That animal is a sheepdog. And you know this because all the sheepdog ministries were part of those ministries. They're all for law enforcement and military, right? They're sheepdog ministries. Now, I will tell you this. Do you think that sheep like sheepdogs? No, they hate them. Well, why? Because the sheepdogs, in many ways, are like the wolves. They're both canines. Do you know that most of us, we're pretty good cops because we're pretty much crooks, basically. Am I right? Am I wrong? In some ways, I can see why sheep don't like us. We're always nipping at their heels. We look, we got teeth just like these guys. We sound just like those guys half the time. I get it. But I will tell you this. If there is a yard full of sheepdogs, we would not have a wolf problem. We have a wolf problem because we don't have enough sheepdogs. Not just in the culture, in the church. Now, all of you who are Christians, you're in the church. Have you been a sheep this entire time? Or have you been a sheepdog? Do you even know why this is true? Why Christianity is true? Can you give me the 6-minute version? Do you have a 6-minute version you could even share? Have you been taking an evidential approach to everything in your professional life, but when it comes to your Christian beliefs, you're like, close enough. Seriously? You're a sheep. We are called to be sheepdogs. You do that professionally. You ought to be teaching this material. You ought to change every one of your churches. You could do that because you have the skill set that they don't have. You're already sheepdogs. And there's a couple of different kinds of sheepdogs, right? My wife and I, we run on the trails in Southern California constantly. One day we're out running in the trails, and I kid you not, there was a picture on a post of a lost dog, a lost chihuahua. Seriously? That's not good news, okay? How long do you think chihuahuas last in that environment, okay? They're this big. I mean, you'd feel much more confident, wouldn't you, if it was a lost Great Dane? You'd be going, oh, yeah, no problem, he can survive. By the way, if you're looking for the lost chihuahua, you're out looking in the woods for the lost chihuahua, looking on the trail, where are you going to look for that chihuahua? I'll tell you where you're going to look. You're going to look in coyote droppings. That's your chihuahua right there. Right? Your Great Dane's over there in the shelter. He's going to make it, no problem. He'll get through, no problem. He can do it. So the question I have for you is, yeah, you're a sheepdog right now in your professional life, but are you a sheepdog in your spiritual life? And if you are, what kind of sheepdog are you?